My name is Harry Mell, editor of the greatest magazine in the solar system. And it's so lovely to see you all here today. Lots of the people who work at the Oldie are extremely self-centered monsters. Well, actually, I'm the only one who is a self-centered monster. We did have one great angel who worked for the Oldie, the late, great Jeremy Lewis, who was deputy editor, complete saint, who wrote a thank you note to every single person who sent in a submission to the Oldie. And we're extremely honoured to have his widow, Petra Lewis, here today to my left. And we've also got his brilliant daughter, Jemima Lewis, who is consultant editor of The Week and a columnist at The Telegraph, but has been attacked by a major outbreak of shyness, so she refuses to talk about her brilliant book. So we've had to get her co-writer from Britain's shyest family, Henry Dimbleby, who also happens to be our husband, to talk about their brilliant book, Ravenous, How to Get Ourselves and Our Planet into Shape. Henry started a distinguished career as a gossip columnist on the Daily Telegraph and then set up the fantastic restaurant chain Lyon, and was the government's food czar and is the co-author of this book. Henry.
Thank you very much, Harry. I'm glad that my rhythm speaking, because there's full-on waterworks on this table, not to mention of Jeremy, who was, amongst other things, one of the greatest father-in-laws a man could have. I was a very bad son-in-law, and often I would go round to Petra and Jeremy's house for Sunday lunch, and I was starting a business, Lyon, and I would kind of, about halfway through, get very tired, take to the sofa and fall asleep, which would be, in most families, divorcing, at least not marrying material. But both Jeremy and Petra used to tend to me, with Petra stroking my toes, and Jeremy saying, poor Henry, he's so tired, and they've since taken my side in absolutely everything against my wife, which I'm very, very grateful for. Anyway, I should say this about Ravenous. So the book we've wrote is basically a story about how humankind solves problems and creates other problems. And this story is really a story about how your generation solved one of the great existential problems of our time, and we now have to solve the problems that that will cause for our children, and then our children will go on, no doubt, to cause problems that their children have to solve, and we'll all fuck up each other's lives. down the generations. So the book starts after the Second World War, when, despite all the bloodshed, there were 2.5 billion people on the planet. And during the war, the one thing that had worried Churchill more than anything else was the U-boat threat. He said after the war that, you know, with the U-boat sank more British shipping up until May of 1943 than we built. He said starvation was one thing that kept him awake at night. And scientists after the Second World War, despite the fact they had destroyed so many largely young men, predicted that we would go from a global population of 2.5 billion to 8 billion, thanks to sanitation, improved healthcare. And there simply wasn't going to be enough land to feed those people. In the 10,000 years since we had become a farming species, basically, when our population had grown, we dug up more land, we planted more food, and there wasn't going to be enough land to plant up. And if you look back to the newspapers of the late 40s, early 50s, this existential threat, this Malthusian threat, was projected to be the big threat to the existence of our species. But what these scientists had not reckoned with was a young botanist from Idaho, a man called Norman Borlaug, who'd grown up in the Great Depression. He had seen hunger firsthand, he'd seen food riots, and he had set himself on a mission to make sure people globally were fed. And at the end of the Second World War, he found himself in Mexico. And when he got there, he wrote back to his wife, and he said, the conditions that I have seen here are so frightening. The soil is so poor, people are barely scraping to survive. We have to do something. This has clubbed my mind. We have to do something. I don't know what we're going to do. We have to do something. And what he did was, he started breeding wheat, and he bred wheat in two places, on the shore and up in the mountains, so that he got two growing seasons every year. And he managed to create a new form of wheat that was short-stemmed, very high-yielding, but short-stemmed, so when the wind blew, it didn't get lodged, it didn't blow over, and was resistant to wheat rust. And he gave this new wheat to the farmers in Mexico that he knew were popular, because he didn't want to be the gringo who'd come in and told them all, this is the wheat you must have. And they planted this wheat, their fields were hugely yielding, and it was taken up widely in Mexico. And by 1960, when Borlaug left Mexico, Mexico was not only self-sufficient in wheat, it was exporting wheat to the rest of the world. And this technology was repeated for maize and for rice around the world. And in what became known as the Green Revolution, we now feed 8 billion people off actually slightly less land than we did in 1945, because when the Soviet Union collapsed, they took a lot of land out of production. And we feed 1.7 times, almost twice the number of calories per person, thanks to this new technique. About 50% of the humans on this planet would not be able to be fed right now if we weren't using the science that Borlaug invented. But we now realise that, as with any problems, when you solve one problem, you create other problems. And the food system that we have completely dominates our environment. The scale of, as an example of the scale of domination, the animals that we breed to eat at any one time, 80 billion of them we slaughter a year, at any one time weigh twice all the weight of all humans and 20 times the weight of all land-dwelling vertebrates and birds, all wild animals. And the food system now is the biggest cause of biodiversity collapse. It's the biggest cause of freshwater pollution and freshwater stress, deforestation, the clearing of the oceans of aquatic life, and with energy, it's the second biggest cause, after energy, it's the second biggest cause of climate change. So if we don't do something, the food system actually is the biggest threat to itself. One of the most frightening charts that we saw, this book, by the way, is based on the National Food Strategy that I wrote for government. One of the most frightening things I saw was NASA projections of what yields would look like globally in a 2.5 degree climate change scenario. And basically what you saw was a big green swathe across the north. Wheat yields in the north, more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, warmer days, wheat yields projected to go up. And the equatorial zones in the south, rice and maize are all red. Yields are going to go down. And what that looks like when you look at it is mass migration, warfare, starvation. It is not a pretty sight. At the same time, as well as destroying the environment and affecting itself, the food we eat is now the biggest threat to our health, by far. So by 2035, the NHS believes that type 2 diabetes is going to cost as much as one diet-related condition is going to cost as much to treat as all cancers do today. That's why Chris Whitty, during lockdown, was giving online lectures in his free time about the problem that diet was causing for the country. So what this book tries to do is to say, how do we address those two things? And a large part of that is because they are flawed systems, we need government intervention. And we set out how government can intervene. But change doesn't just happen from the top down. You need care from the bottom up. There's never been a meal that's been cooked by one human being for another that was delicious and nutritious that didn't happen because someone cared, someone loved what they were doing. And so what I would urge you to do while we wait for government to act, from the bottom up, do what you can do in your communities to improve the food. That might be going and visiting your children or grandchildren's schools for lunch. If it's a primary school, it's a fantastic thing to do. You feel like the king or the queen. But it can make the change. Engage with if you can cook, teach your godchildren, your children to cook. And if you can't cook, buy a copy of this book and give it to your child or grandchild so they know how to solve the problems that we have to solve from the problem that you solved that's now caused the problems we have to solve. Thank you very much.